This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we are starting today on Beacon Hill, where we are expecting Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey to be making her way down the hall to join us for a monthly conversation, a check-in on the Commonwealth. I understand that the governor's sitting down right now, so let me just tee it up while she gets prepared. Lots of questions today, and what was really interesting to us is when we asked you to text us with your questions, and you can join that texting group by sending the word Boston to 617-766-0382. That's Boston to 617-766-0382. Fully a third of your questions were on the tee. You wanted to know about education and a few other things as well. Well, I think the governor is now with us. I think our WBUR senior state house reporter Steve Brown helped her get settled in. Governor Healey, are you there?
I am. Good morning, Tiziana.
Welcome. It's great to have you, Governor, and thanks. I know it's a busy schedule. I think we'll jump right in because originally I like to start with, usually I like to start with something a little fun, but I want to note that just shortly before you signed on just now, the state's Department of Public Health released a directive reminding pharmacies that it's state law in Massachusetts to carry and fulfill prescriptions for abortion pills. This comes as Walgreens, which is a national pharmacy chain, says it won't offer those medications in 21 states. So with that just sort of echoing in our ears in the last little bit, Governor, why was it important to release this directive now?
Because we protect reproductive rights in Massachusetts. I've been really clear as governor. I will do everything in my power and authority to make sure that we're protecting women's access to reproductive health care. And, you know, unfortunately, we've seen states around the country rushing to ban safe and effective medication abortion. And we just wanted to remind our pharmacies here that we won't tolerate those who are restricting anyone who restricts access to it. Again, these are safe and effective methods, and we just wanted to send guidance and a message, in given what the national context has been, to our pharmacies here that they have an obligation to provide mifepristone and other reproductive health medications.
So you mentioned that national context. I think that's good to bring to our listeners. A judge in Texas heard oral arguments in a case that could impact that. A ruling could pull the pills from the U.S. or one of the two pills or direct the FDA to impose tougher restrictions. That would then, I'm assuming, affect the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. The judge says he's going to rule quickly. Seems like the expectation is there's a good chance he will rule in this direction. What does that mean for the Commonwealth if that happens, Governor?
Well, we'll do everything to fight that and ensure that women continue to have access to medication abortion as well as access to other reproductive health care measures. You know, that is a lawsuit. We'll see what any decision looks like and what appeals look like, and that will work its way through the process. But I'm going to be really clear as governor, and our Health and Human Services Secretariat is really clear that we are going to do everything in our power to make sure that women continue to receive access to the care that they need. And it's really unfortunate. We've talked about this, you know, in the past. We now live in a post-Roe world. I am grateful to all those, including our legislature here, who've stood strong in passing legislation to, you know, codify and make sure that women have access to the care that they need. And I think we'll just continue to do that here in the state.
Are you and the Attorney General in contact about this, given that it's a legal proceeding? And when you were Attorney General, this is the kind of thing I might have expected to see you paying close attention to?
Oh, I know that the Attorney General is paying close attention to this particular case. As a state, we're in the case as an amicus and would be going forward in any appeals, I'm sure. So the Attorney General and I are very much of the same view when it comes to ensuring that we do everything in our power here in the state to make sure that women have access to needed care.
Okay, so I want to take a step back. That's a very, very serious subject, but you just sat down. I do want to have a little fun with you because this has been on my mind since Sunday. I'm going to play a little bit of sound for you.
I brought up the jar, basketball references. It's the equivalent of our swear jar. I know you're sick of it. Here's our contribution.
Any hoop references, you're paying up, okay? All of you this morning.
We know you're tired of it. We decided to make some money off of it.
And look, the tea, not a novel idea to make fun of today. So if you're making fun of the tea, you're paying up too.
And maybe at the end we'll have enough money for our next general manager's signing bonus.
So warming up the crowd at the St. Patrick's Day breakfast this weekend, you, Lieutenant Governor Kim Driscoll, that sound came from CBS Boston. How much money was in the jar at the end, and what did you do with it?
there was a fair amount of money in the jar. And I think we gave it away. I'm not quite sure what happened to it. We certainly didn't take it home. But, you know, I think a couple things. One, you know, the lieutenant governor and I, yes, we come from a sports background. We both played college ball. We really do believe in teamwork and the spirit of all that and what it means to compete and what it means to support your teammates. And I think that is a mentality that we've brought to this administration. We're all working together inside, outside of government, working together across secretariats. And, you know, that's just the vibe that we are about. And we also had to poke fun at ourselves about the tea, of course. I do want people to know that I am really, really serious about us addressing the issues there. We are in the final stages. Expect to be naming a new GM and also transportation safety chief very, very soon.
When? Do you know? Are we talking about a week?
Very soon.
Are we talking 2 weeks?
It will be very soon. And what I want folks to know is this transportation safety chief, this is an entirely new position that I'm creating because it's so important that people have confidence in the safety and reliability of our public transit. And, you know, I've also talked repeatedly about the fact that the T and what's happened there happened over the course of many, many years. And we can go and do the forensics on that. But, you know, what I'm really interested in is what is it we need to do right now? And I'm telling the public right now, we need this new leadership team in place and to build out support there. But what we really, really need are workers. We're down 800-900 positions right now. People who can do maintenance, safety, who can drive buses, operators on the rail and subway. We need workers, and you know we are really intent on doing that hiring. We think it's a great, you know,
so how,
it can
though?
Be a great career opportunity.
Seriously,
we just put
this,
forward
in this tough market, and I'm mindful of this. Like, so I'm thinking back to talking with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu when she first came on, mm-hmm. and her talking about, listen, some of this couldn't happen as fast as I wanted it to because it turned out it's a tough hiring market. Given that the T's down on employees from bus drivers, for example, from the beginning of the year, what are the, you know, the sweeteners? What can you actually do to get them staffed up?
Well, I think, you know, part of it is morale and making sure that we change a culture where people feel pretty beat up. I was recently talking to a dispatcher who formerly was a bus driver. And, you know, he talks about the way in which sometimes the public engages with the bus drivers. And, you know, if you have a choice between doing that job and working somewhere else, and there are a lot of choices right now, you're going to go somewhere else. So here's what we're doing. I have sought specific funding to do a more intensive recruitment effort. It's not just about signing bonuses. It's not just about higher pay, though we have proposed both, to be clear. It's also about really going into communities and going to find people who might not have thought about this as a career, but can be brought in. And that's what we're set on doing right now. And to bring them in and to say, like, look, this can be a great career. It is the case, and it still is the case, that you can start in one position and work your way up, and it can be a great, great career. So that's the effort that we're engaged in right now. And again, after years of underinvestment, things falling into declining states of disrepair, you know, that's what we are living with right now. That's the reason there are slow zones. That's the reason that you know we've seen some of the recent news. It's just a reflection of years and years of underinvestment and allowing things to get to a place on what is the country's oldest subway system, get to a place that that is not up to where it needs to be. But
so
we definitely need these staff vacancies filled.
Governor, let me give you a chance to respond directly to some listeners. You might have heard as you were sitting down that about a third of the texts that we got from listeners were on the MBTA. I'm going to read two to you and then just give you a chance to respond. So first comes Claire of Dorchester. This text is sent from a crowded, slow red line train at rush hour. I would like to challenge Governor Healey to take the MBTA to work for a week, take the T during rush hour when she needs to be at a specific place at a specific time. And then Tahir of Alston said, will the next GM of the MBTA be required to, as they should, to take public transportation on a regular basis and not just for a photo op? So listen, you've already said you want to speak directly to people, and you know there's pain there. There's this sense, and you've heard it before, we heard it during the Baker administration, that an administration who's not on the T doesn't suffer with the riders of the T. How do you respond to that, especially when we are still in this space with many of the lines with at least some slow zones after the lines fully had slow zones for a while there?
Right. Well, I completely sympathize with riders like Claire. I mean, people need, this needs to be in a different place, and it is incredibly frustrating. I have total sympathy with commuters out there, with riders out there who need a safe and reliable transit system to get to school, to get to work. It just cannot be. Obviously, the status quo is unacceptable. And that's why, you know, I've come in and I've taken the approach, I'm not going to look the other way. We're going to get our hands dirty on this. We're going to do what needs doing.
So
it will take some time. It will take some time. But I think with the new leadership and also getting more workers, you know, we have to get more workers in, because these repairs that, you know, didn't happen that should have happened, a lot of this has to go towards just staffing and workforce issues. And, you know, it's unfortunate. I walk into a situation where, you know, we're woefully understaffed, but, you know, I view it as my responsibility as governor to do everything that I can to put the pieces in place so that riders like Claire don't have to have more miserable commuting experiences.
So last question on this, and if it sounds like I'm being cute with this, I don't mean to be. Would it make a difference to voters if they felt you were regularly on the T and feeling the pain that they're feeling?
Well, I talk to people every day who take the T, including, you know, many of the folks I work with regularly here in the office. So I'm really familiar with the plight of those who are riding the T. I think what the public needs to see is a T that's working. They need to see trains running on time. They need the slow zones to go away. The slow zones are there for a reason, because it's dangerous to have these trains operating, again, on the country's oldest railway, at higher speeds when there are identified safety issues on the track. And so that's why we have the slow zones. The teams are out there every day, every night, working to address those and repair those. But I think what the public needs to see is they need to see action. They need to see the trains literally moving on time.
I'm going to switch gears here, and I'm thinking about some news of the day. We'll start with this sort of the state of banks in Massachusetts and the country after the crisis with Silicon Valley Bank. You know, as an executive leader in the state, I imagine you've got at least some mental dashboard. So when it comes to where we are with bank security, financial security here in the state, given where we are with Silicon Valley Bank, First Republic, Credit Suisse, what is now green on your dashboard? It's okay now, and it wasn't before. And what's still red on your dashboard that you're watching really closely as things unfold?
Well, this was a pretty devastating turn of events. Massachusetts had a disproportionate number of entities, people and companies affected by SVB. We worked very, very closely and intensely over that weekend, talking to our folks in the banking industry, talking to the federal delegation. I was specifically on the phone with members of the Biden administration on this issue. Obviously, the relief came for SVB, and that's important. But I think going forward, here's what the public needs to know. Our regional banks are strong. They're really strong. Our core banking functions are strong. And there is no reason for people to not keep or put deposits in our regional banks. They are strong. The second thing we need to see, though, is action by Congress. They do need to up the limit for FDIC, for insurance. It's too low right now.
It's Senator currently Warren at $250,000 protected deposits.
They need to increase that, okay? And I credit Senator Warren. She's the one who's been leading the charge on this. We really, really need Congress to act.
Last question on this. As you look to prevent future impact here, you're talking about how strong our regional banks are. I know what you want from Congress. I am really curious about the public-private discussions that must be ongoing. I know that there was a lot of reporting on it in sort of the immediate response, the couple of days after Silicon Valley Bank fell into crisis. Is there any infrastructure that came from that, right, that you can keep going as governor and in your administration that creates an early warning system for future problems? Does my question make sense, Governor Healey?
Yeah, I mean, here, unfortunately, there was an early warning system, and SVB was alerted by the feds that it was on thin ice, and unfortunately, they chose not to act and do the right thing until it was too late. I think what the public should know is there's a lot of conversation, there's a lot of infrastructure that exists when it comes to the state and our relationships with private industry. I think about, for example, you know, this instance where so many of our tech companies, life sciences companies, other firms and entities backed by venture capital or startups, right? These are huge economic engines for Massachusetts. These are things, you know, companies and sectors that have been our calling card in so many respects. And what's important is that, you know, this gave us a chance and my administration a chance led by our fabulous Economic Development Secretary, Yvonne Howe, to work directly with our Mass Life Sciences Center, our Mass Tech Collaborative, and connect with, you know, industry and think about the ways we can better support as a state, with the work that they are doing. So, you know, a lot of it when it comes to actual banking and where people are going to put money and the ease of lending, that is really something that the state doesn't have control over. We have some lending programs that we do, and we're going to continue to support those programs. But I think where the state can help out is really building that fabric and that partnership with these entities that are looking to grow here. And that gets to issues of permitting. It gets to issues of transportation, because you want to create an environment where employees can come and go to work. Housing, which is a huge issue, the cost of housing here in the state, and something that we have made a priority. As you know, I've created a secretary of housing position, and we are really going to be driving housing production around the state so that we can get lower prices. I think these are some of the ways that, and this is coming directly from the people that we've been talking with in these sectors. That's what these sectors need to see from the state.
Let's pick up on some other subjects. I'm going to stay in news of the day for a minute. We're talking with Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey from the State House. And it's a bit of a punchless governor, but there's a lot going on right now. And there are some things I know our listeners really want to hear about. I want to talk about the state police search, where you are the first governor with the ability to hire a new head of the state police from outside the system. You've made it clear you're looking everywhere, inside and outside. There's a search team together. Do you have a timeline for interviews and naming a candidate?
Well, you're right. I did something that hadn't been done before. I engaged a search firm. I also appointed a terrific search committee. And their charge is to work as quickly as possible to identify the best person possible for this job. And so they're already hard at work at that. Obviously, I want to get somebody in place, you know, as soon as possible, but we also want to make sure we get the right person in place. And as you say, I've been clear that this is a search that is open now beyond the ranks of the Massachusetts State Police for the first time.
So on Monday, we had the new Secretary of Education, Patrick Tutwiler, on. We had a deep and ranging conversation with him. We found out in preparing for that, he's really big into grilling. He's big into barbecuing, wants to do a cookbook that maybe only his family will read one day. I do want to ask you, have you cooked outside yet this season? And do you join him in the love of all things grilled?
Well, I love our Secretary of Education. I love all of our secretaries. They're just super talented people who are committed to the public interest. And certainly Secretary Pat Tutwiler, former teacher, superintendent, principal, now your Secretary of Education is just terrific. In terms of his grilling, I am not taking on Pat. He's a master griller. I do like to grill myself, and I do like to cook outside. Have I yet this year? I don't think I have in 2023, but it's warmer now. I feel like spring is upon us. So
that's right.
We'll be out soon. But I just want to underscore what a champion he is for our young people and really looking at the whole spectrum. We put a ton of money in our proposed budget for early education and childcare. We made historic investments in public higher ed. And we also made historic investments in our budget proposal for local aid for school districts.
I won't go into
including some of our rural school districts, which you know disproportionately have challenges that we need to help address.
Okay, so actually, let's pick up on that. Then you just talked about the rural. I actually, Governor, have a terrible time saying the word rural, so let me try it again there. The rural school districts. One of the things that you've done is you've created a new appointment, right? A new position, who is a rural affairs director, which, as I understand it, is really to kind of bring Western Massachusetts into the everyday awareness and sense of connection with political Greater Boston. I know that there's been a desire by Western Massachusetts in the past for that role. Why specifically did you do it? What's the pain point you were looking at getting at? And when do you think you can have that in place?
Well, I'm really excited about this new position. And let me just explain what it is. You know, there are 181 rural communities in Massachusetts, down on the Cape, up in Essex County, you know, North Central, yes, Western Massachusetts, but 181 rural communities. And these communities need help and investment and partnership with the state. And the way we're going to get there is by putting someone in charge of that. And that person is going to be doing everything from meeting regularly with local officials and leaders to talk about and identify what they need. We're going to work to provide technical assistance to our communities. A lot of these communities, they have volunteer fire departments, or they have, you know, they don't have the functions, obviously, that some of our bigger places, communities have in terms of systems and infrastructure. And, you know, the state can help out in providing some of that assistance. Economic development, our rural economy. You know, we were in Deerfield and Greenfield a couple weeks ago visiting farms that are literally feeding people and also, you know, huge potential economic drivers for the region. And, you know, we want to make sure our rural communities get the support they need for housing, rehabilitation and renovation, for help with things like dairy farmers, additional tax credits for them so they're not subject to price volatility and the market. More funding for these communities to assist with school, with transportation,
so really core services, Governor Healey. It sounds
It is, because you know, again, these communities just are smaller and not as built out in terms of infrastructure, and you know, as a result, they not only feel left behind, but they are left behind from some of what we see, say, in Greater Boston. With the economic development and what's happening here.
So I'm going to interrupt you there, and I apologize for that. It's not out of disrespect, but we've got a couple.
I'm excited about it. I'm super excited about it. We're going to name someone soon. It's going to be great for the state.
So I want to talk about another appointment. When you were on Radio Boston last time, I remember we were talking about federal grants. You said, I don't just want us to compete. Let me be clear. I don't just want us to compete. I want us to win. And I remember thinking at the end of that conversation, this is an initiative for this governor. And now we have this appointment of Quentin Palfrey, who formerly ran for lieutenant governor, formerly ran for attorney general, has served in the Biden administration, served in the Patrick administration, director of federal funds and infrastructure. How does adding that role make us win?
Because right now, we are competing not just with every other state, we're competing with other cities for federal funding. Big bipartisan legislation passed the last couple of years, the Inflation Reduction Act, the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, the CHIPS and Science Act. These are bills that created huge pots of federal funds that states and cities can compete for. And My view coming in is that Massachusetts, we need to step up our game and compete hard to bring home these critical funds. And we're going to do that, you know, working together with our federal delegation, working across state agencies, working with communities, working with our research institutes, our colleges and universities, and our private industry. I put Quentin Palfrey in charge as our director of federal funds. Incidentally, he also worked in the Commerce Department, and some of this funding is coming directly out of the Commerce Department. I created this position because it's essential that Massachusetts have a point person who is there to build the team and lead the charge to apply for and secure as much funding as we can for key infrastructure, economic development, transportation, climate projects, just to name a few examples. And so that's you know, my view is I wanted somebody in charge who can report to me and can be working day in and day out to help us apply for and put our best effort forward in securing these funds. I mean, you think about the legislation that I just named. I mean, the legislation alone, in it, there's $1 trillion for climate alone. And I've said I want Massachusetts to lead, and part of leading is getting the resources that are going to help us build out and do the projects that we know will be transformative for this state.
So I want to go back to our texting group, and to join it, listeners can join by sending the word Boston to 617-766-0382. All kinds of questions. I'm a little curious. Kumara of Rutland asked, I just got into sports betting. Who are your March Madness picks for both the men's and women's teams? I would be interested in your bracket and whether you are going to venture into sports betting now that it's legal in the state.
Well, hi, Kumara. I'm probably not going to bet, though sports betting has come on, and you know, I hope it goes well and there's revenue for the state and people bet safely. I can't encourage them to bet wisely. March Madness, I have to say, my picks, I think South Carolina for the women are going to be really tough to beat, although UConn is coming on strong. As for the men, I don't know. It's so many ones have lost. It's been so much fun. I always, no matter what game is on, I just like find myself automatically rooting for the underdog, no matter what game. and we've got another couple weeks of it, so it's great.
So we'll wait and see. All right. Well, I'm sure that South Carolina and UConn will appreciate those shout outs.
I don't know what my brackets actually said. I know they got pretty blown up though.
Yeah.
And shout out to the Harvard women who were competing in the third round of the NIT this Thursday in Cambridge.
All right. Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey, we'll talk to you again next month. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, great to be with you. Look forward to it.
Libertarians have been moving to New Hampshire. It's a particular group called Free Staters, and they are responding to a call in 2016 for 20,000 like-minded people to move into the state over 5 years. They've caused political stir, they've caused political controversy in New Hampshire, and this week, NBC 10 Boston airs the last of an 11-part docuseries on the Free Staters. It's called Free Staters, Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of New Hampshire. It's a deep dive into the Free State movement just north of us. It's fascinating, it's scary, it's funny, it's real. And with us here in the studio, Allison King and Shira Stoll. Allison is a political reporter. Shira is a video producer, both for NBC 10 Boston. Shira, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Allison, good to see you again.
You as well.
All right, I have questions. Many questions. But I'm just going to start with, how did you even come across this story in the first place, Allison?
So, you know, I've been covering politics for a long time, spent a lot of time up in New Hampshire, and I kind of heard about the Free Staters over the years. Free State this, oh, that's a Free State that, and I just kind of, yeah, whatever. And then last spring, I heard that the town of Croydon, the small rural town of Croydon, had cut its school budget by 50%. And it's because a Free Stater put out this proposal, and it was on a day where very few people showed up for town meeting, and lo and behold, it passed. So I thought that's kind of interesting. There's that Free Staters again. And then I heard they were putting a secession bill through the state house, and I thought, that's really? And so we started to sort of, I started to show up in Croydon and we checked out what was going on there, and we found out, wow, this is a really big story, and we need to cover this.
All right, so you've just laid out a bunch of the stuff that I want to talk about, including, Shira, at the end. What was it like to cover this? Were they cooperative, et cetera? I do want to start, though, by kind of setting up for listeners so they can follow this journey with us, who the Free Staters are. And I'm going to start with just a little bit of sound here.
The Free State Project is simply about getting people who believe in freedom and limited government to move to New Hampshire.
We are the live free or die state.
We all agree on the one important thing, which is non-aggression principle. Don't hurt people, don't take their stuff.
Don't hurt people, don't take their stuff.
We believe in economic freedom, personal freedom. We want government to be as local as possible.
I just want lower taxes, smaller government, more individual freedom.
And that is, Shira, a number of people, including Jason Sorens in episode one there, who are kind of the characters that you're following. That's a summary, right?
Right.
You put it together, so I But does it capture everything you want people to understand about what a Free Stater is?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something really actually important to know about the Free Staters. They tend to be put in this box. Oh, Free Staters, and they want this, and they want that. The reality is that there's a whole spectrum of people that are in the Free State Project movement. I mean, some of them do want no government and they want to secede. Some of them don't. Some of them want smaller government. I think that that's really been the one thing that does kind of bind them together. They're sort of the two. One is smaller government, and then two is this non-aggression principle. Don't hurt people, don't take their stuff. And it's sort of that fundamental libertarian idea that they've all that they feel like sort of binds them all together, that they abide by those things.
And I want to stay with the libertarian word, Allison, for a minute to kind of, especially because, I mean, you've been covering politics long enough to see the Tea Party, to see Occupy, right? To see the various manifestations of pushes for small government, et cetera. Explain where we are with libertarianism and libertarianism in New Hampshire right now.
Well, I mean, libertarianism nationally, and this is why Jason Sorens started this whole thing as a Yale grad student 20 years ago, have not made a lot of traction. There's pockets of them around the country. They're very active and passionate about what they believe, but they don't have the numbers in any particular state around the country. And his whole notion was, if we all gather in one state, we'll have that political clout where we'll actually be able to make a difference and have this libertarian utopia we're hoping for. But there is that big L libertarian, the party, and there's the small L libertarian, which is you have these libertarian ideals, you believe in, you know, lesser government, lower taxes, and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, I think that they, in New Hampshire, they have definitely, New Hampshire tends to be a libertarian-leaning state anyway, live free or die on their license plate and their motto. But it's still definitely a minority type of, you know, party or type of group of people, I should say. But they are building in numbers.
All right. So, and just briefly, back to you, Shira, I guess I want to really mark for listeners, part of the reason we're talking about libertarianism and Free Staters and New Hampshire is Jason Sorens, who first in a manifesto that kind of took on a life of its own, suggested, what if we could get 20,000 sort of libertarian-ish like-minded people all to move to a state in 5 years, throw it down, be here within the next 5 years, see what we can do. Yeah. And that actually kind of happened, and they picked New Hampshire, and in 2016 they said, on your mark, get set, go.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, they actually, so they voted on a state. There were 11, I think 10 or 11 that they were debating between, and New Hampshire wound up winning. And they've been, they've been moving there. I will say that they're estimated about like 6,000 to 7,000. We're not really 100% sure how many are in the state. But for New Hampshire, which is a low population state.
About 1.5 million people.
Like, I mean, you know, they're still making some progress, even if there aren't, they haven't reached that 20,000 goal. They are getting, you know, elected into the state house, and they have put forward some bills. So they are making traction, even if they are still kind of small right now.
We're talking with Shira Stoll and Allison King of NBC 10 Boston about an 11-part docuseries on Free Staters in New Hampshire, the last portion, episode 11, which I saw aired this week. Okay, so now I want to dive into who this group is a little bit more. Kind of, we're in the how it started phase. We will get to the how it's going phase, which we'll get to Croydon, we'll get to Succession, et cetera. But I want to stay here a little bit longer. And this is a little sound from two attendees at a thing called Porkfest.
I mean, it's kind of like Christian camp with harder drugs.
You have a bunch of people walking around heavily armed and trading pot brownies. People think that's impossible, but it's here, and nobody gets shot, and nobody overdoses. It really is this magical little place for a week.
So Porkfest, because of the porcupine, which I'd like a little more understanding of. And it is this interesting meeting of what would stereotypically be considered very liberal. For example, sort of free-ranging community, lots of drugs, et cetera, and what stereotypically would be considered very conservative, which is, I'm going to open carry and keep your hands off my guns. So how do you make sense of this place?
Yeah, this is where I go back to the spectrum. It's really wide, group of different types of people. I kind of went into it thinking originally, these are conservative people. They're probably Trumpers. They're probably people, guns and... The reality is they're not. They don't like Trump or Biden. They are very broad political spectrum, and they basically, it's that lesser government issue. And why the porcupine? The porcupine's a non-aggressive animal, but if you go at it, it will come back at you hard.
And it does hurt a lot.
So I'm going to let Shira talk about Porkfest because she was there for 3 days.
Yeah, we spent 3 days there.
We spent three days there, Dan Farragan and I, who's the other producer. And so Porcupine Freedom Festival, so Porkfest, P-O-R-C, Porcupine Freedom Festival, So that was actually sort of the first time that we had met Free State Project members. So our first two interviews were actually Jason Sorens and Xander Rice Hawkins, who is the executive director of Granite State Progress. And she's sort of tracking the Free Staters and a little worried about it.
And she's the counterpoint in your documentary series.
Exactly. And so the third thing that we went to was Porkfest, and that's where we met people. And, we were going up there, and we weren't really sure what to expect because, all we knew was that they didn't like the government and they probably didn't like the media, and we knew that they were probably going to have guns. And so we weren't really sure what to expect. But it wound up really being this, just a festival where they just let loose. They're able to – everybody just kind of, they abide by this non-aggression principle. People leave out like a $100 bill and nobody touches it kind of thing. But they also
don't hurt anyone, don't steal anyone's stuff.
Exactly. Don't hurt anyone, don't steal their stuff. They play kickball. They have talks where they talk about, whether it's politics or they just have like a karaoke event or something. It's just a festival where they're, enjoying
and
freedom.
Almost to a person, they talk about how they came to this festival, and for the first time in their lives, they found their people. Yep. They were comfortable. They found community.
So I want to stay there because there's this interesting tension, right? Especially episode two, where you lay out Porkfest. I want to introduce this here to Julian, and I hope I pronounce his last name right, Aciard, one of the very few people of color in the docuseries. He's interviewed at Porkfest. He's wearing a T-shirt that says, "All gun control is racist."
The foundation of gun control was to stop freed slaves from seeking repercussions against their slave owners. Honestly, more guns means more freedom.
And he's an interesting juxtaposition there, both because we're increasingly aware, we've talked about this a little bit, but not a lot on Radio Boston, about the move towards black gun ownership in America, mm-hmm. but also because this is a white movement, Shira, to look at this documentary series. We see Julian, we see mostly white people, lots of white men, and it is an interesting look at that idea that if you take a lot of regulation and government away, it's gonna work out for you. Well, historically, that's been true for white people. So I wonder where race kind of mixed into your exploration of the identity of this group.
I want to push on that a little because it's not a white movement, I would say. It is more diverse than what we show in the film. I have to say that working on this, a lot of Free Staters are very hesitant to speak to the media. And we noticed that actually a lot of Free Staters of color were hesitant to speak to the media.
So I'm glad I asked.
So I do want to say that, yes, we did interview about 90 people for this documentary on all sides, people who are involved, people who support it, people who don't. But I will say that we had a hard time getting a lot of people to talk to us and open up about it because they are very hesitant about hesitant to speak to the media.
So, Allison, I'll ask one more question, then we'll take a quick pause. What else? Why? Why are they? I mean, we're all media. Why did people not want to talk to the media?
Oh, gosh. I think they feel like they've been misrepresented for decades, the libertarian movement, that they've been pigeonholed as this is what they want to do, this, they want to do that. So they just avoid the media altogether. I do think that they basically, it took us a long time to sort of, you know, sort of earn trust with some of these people to get them to talk to us and open up. And, you know, I think that you just can't, I think not pigeonholing them in any way, shape, or form is just really an important part of all this to keep in mind. Just
all right.
That, yeah.
Allison King and Shira Stoll of NBC 10 Boston are still with us as we talk about the docuseries they've created called Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of New Hampshire, about the Free State Movement in New Hampshire. Allison, I'll turn back to you now. When I asked you how you found out about the story, one of the first things that you brought up was a small town called Croydon and the school district there, and the fact that when not a lot of people were paying attention, I don't mean that nefariously, that's just the fact. At a meeting, there was a proposal that passed to reduce the original school budget by 54%. I've got a little sound here from Ian Underwood, who sort of got that going.
This is the discussion I was hoping to have. I didn't actually believe that the thing would pass at the time. I just wanted to have a big discussion, and then it did pass. And then I'm like, well, it's kind of like the dog who caught the car. Now what do I do with it?
And it did pass 20 to 13. Then there's a fight in the town to try to get it pulled back. Here's Amanda Leslie, who's an English teacher in Croydon that you guys call a concerned New Hampshire resident.
They want to dismantle public education, defund it to the point where it's up to parents to pay to educate their kids.
And a little more from Amanda Leslie here.
We all are so busy, and it's easy to become complacent, but I think this showed that you can't trust necessarily that the people who are elected or appointed are going to operate in good faith.
So, wow. I mean, just a whole microcosm of how towns work there.
Well, it was, you know, these are towns that have town meeting, good old-fashioned New England town meeting. Typically, very few people show up. Let's face it. I mean, all of us who work and have kids, we, you know, a lot of us do not go to our local school board meeting. And this is what happened. And, you know, one of the things that kind of came out of this is that if you care about where your community's going, don't assume that everyone in your community feels the way you do. When Ian Underwood said, gee, I didn't know this was going to happen, it wasn't because he didn't want it to happen. He wanted it to. He just thought, wow, this, I just threw this against the wall and now we have to deal with it. But, you know, I think that was a key theme of this whole thing is the importance of being involved and knowing what's going on in your community.
So that brings up an interesting point, too, Shira, which is, you know, Allison just said it's not that Ian didn't want it to happen. He just didn't think it would happen. Mm-hmm. And we heard from Amanda there this growing sense that a town member thinks something nefarious is going on with the Free Staters. And then we see, actually technically in the docuseries, we see first the move towards secession and a bill that goes before the state legislature, which also seems to be a moment that puts the Free State movement at real loggerheads with both Democrats and Republicans in New Hampshire.
Yes, and just real quick before we move to secession, I just want to go back. I mean, Ian Underwood didn't expect it to pass, but he, you know, he had it very thought out. I mean, he brought in a pamphlet with written information about how this could work, why it was important, the correlation between, you know, education and the amount of money that you would spend. So I think it is interesting to, or important to just put that out there, that it wasn't like, I'm just going to cut the budget because we want lower taxes and just, you know, see what happens. He was really, you know, his point was that, well, education's not getting any better here. So, you know, what if we, why spend more money? Exactly. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
Okay. And briefly pick up the secession piece as well.
Yes. So, so in January, a bunch of Free Staters got together. They wrote a bill to propose secession. Now, not that we should vote on if New Hampshire should secede. It's that it should be on the ballot to let New Hampshire residents decide if they should secede or not. So basically leaving it up to the people of New Hampshire, hey, is, you know, government working for you? Do you want to become your own country? If yes, you know, let's secede. And if not, let's not. It was not, but I think that maybe that had, you know, when you say secession, it's a scary word. I mean, you know, breaking up the United States creates a lot of chaos. And, you know, and putting that on the ballot could, if people did vote for it, obviously, you know, create a you know, something pretty crazy.
So,
yeah.
Allison, what I found myself thinking, both in watching it and listening to the two of you now, is this emerging feel as the docuseries goes on That it is not clear who is sort of, what's the word, operating in good faith and who's not, in terms of lots of arguments from the Free Staters. Hey, we just want the voters to be able to decide. Lots of real fear from others saying, no, you don't just want the voters to decide. You are trying to come in, take over our state, and force us to do something we don't want to do. And then we get to the end and you introduce this whole set of concepts that is, listen, this is what's happening with everybody. You've got these main, these big political streams, and then lots of people on a wide spectrum, like you said already twice, Allison, right, who exist in it. So, it, you know, in the end, live and let live, there's something nefarious going on here. We don't really know. Kind of, how did you find yourself feeling as it was coming to a close?
Yeah. So, I mean, by the way, we really made an intentional, we intentionally did not want to put our thumb on the scale on this in any way, shape, or form. So a lot of people, you know, say, wow, those are crazy, whack, you know, wacky people. What was it like? You know what? We just said, you tell your story and we'll hear from both sides on this. I feel like... You know, there is an anarchist element of the Free Staters. It's not the broad majority of them, I would say. But I think that some people go right to some of the anarchists who get in the faces of people and want to secede. And I'm not sure that's the fairest representation of the Free State. But for sure, if you're someone who believes in a thriving public school system and that government is there to help people out and to be there as a safety net and... Yes, then the Free State is a threat to what you believe. So it's really about where you come from.
So, Shira, I'm going to play one more piece of sound for you here. This is Jason Sorens, who's sort of the founder of the Free State movement again.
So far, I would say the Free State Project has exceeded my initial expectations because I didn't actually expect that it would work. I didn't actually expect that anyone would move. I hoped that it would happen. But I thought that this probably won't work, but it has a better chance of working than anything else that I see out there.
So what do you guys watch now? What do you watch for now?
What will happen next?
Yeah. What's the big question that you are left with after 11 episodes of this docuseries?
I want to know what happens in 20 years. I mean, the last... The ending, the last maybe 2 minutes of it, is the Free Staters say, I want a Free State governor. I want a Free State this. There's going to be, you know, elections where you have a Free State Democrat running against a Free State Republican, running against a Free State Libertarian. And then you have Xandra on the other side saying, I hope that this is a blip on the radar, you know, just a random reference in a history book. I mean, and I want to know what happens. I'm so curious to know. And literally the last line of the film is, you know, it's up to people to make up their own minds.
And I feel like we're in a tipping point, and I think the next few years are really going to tell whether this is going to sort of fade off into the sunset or whether their numbers are going to grow. And I think they haven't had a great year between secession, Croydon, Gunstock. They've lost those battles. We'll see where it goes.
All right. Allison King, Shira Stoll, the team behind NBC10's docuseries Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of New Hampshire. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Thanks for listening. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow. We're going to do another show.